Hello, good evening, welcome. I am Samuel Trapp. This is Damn Radio that you are listening to, and my show is called International Flavor. Had some news occur that interfered with some of the things I was going to jump into right away, but how about a rather large earthquake in Alaska? What are you thinking of that? Unbelievable. And 7.3, I think they said it was, 7.2 off of the, 7.3 struck off Alaska's southern coast earlier today, the 16th, around 12:30, 4 o'clock Eastern time, basically, 3:37 Eastern, 12:37 Alaska time, it's far west. Tsunami situation was initially issued along an entire 700-mile stretch of Alaska's southern coast. They were telling people to evacuate. They were telling people to go at least a mile inland. They were telling people to get up in elevation, so many feet. But the best option was to go inland at least a mile. And they were that serious about it because it was a bad earthquake. Well, you kind of appreciate that. I don't know if any of you saw that movie, whatever the heck the name of it was, about the British family that was in Indonesia whenever it was, that huge tsunami. That huge tsunami hit over there. But tell you what, you probably prefer the warning, and it was along that entire the entire coast, the southern coast of Alaska, right? And it was like 83 miles inland, or not inland, 80 miles into the ocean, 83. And they were thinking that it would build up and do something similar to what occurred in Indonesia way back when. But the coastal communities included Sand Point, Kodiak, Unalaska, King Cove, Cold Bay were ordered to evacuate to higher ground, move to at least 50 feet above sea level or 1 mile inland. So about an hour later, the warning was downgraded to a tsunami advisory, and then it was canceled a little bit before 3 p.m. So throughout the alert, there was no significant wave activity. Some tide gauges recorded slight sea level changes of a few inches. No report of damage or casualties that have come out. Multiple aftershocks, though. And they are really keeping an eye on it because saying that there were 40 aftershocks in the first 3 hours, and the largest was a 5.2 magnitude, which is a big earthquake in its own right. That's a pretty big deal. And so I don't know. It's authorities anticipate, quite a few more of these aftershocks could include some 6+ magnitude within the week, coming up this week. So the quake was felt as far away as Anchorage, about 600 miles to the northeast, as felt in Juneau, and even across the border into British Columbia. So the tsunami risk was actually lowered because apparently 54 to 55 miles south of Sand Point, that occurred at a moderate ocean depth, 9 to 22 miles, while it's large enough to trigger alerts, it didn't generate a powerful tsunami. Unlike the mega tsunami events like in 1958, there were no massive underwater landslides or sudden vertical displacements of water or land, here. So the last quake of this size in the region was 1996, and the most extreme seismic event was the 1964 Good Friday earthquake, which was 9.2 magnitude. So we're very glad that nothing happened up there in Alaska. I spent the month of January there in 1989. I don't know. But it was the coldest winter on record. And there I was sleeping in a motor pool. They had something called, I was in the Army, of course, and they had something called weatherproofing. So you had to go to Alaska, and then they had to weatherproof you. And in order to weatherproof, this is going to tell you how what a nut I am. So in order to weatherproof, me and my friend Arthur Bailey, who was a very tall black man, who went to Howard University in Washington, D.C., he was a the nicest guy. He was the best man at my second wedding, real good guy. And he and I got sent up to Alaska. We're freezing our asses off. Arthur found himself a couple of stewardesses on the flight. Couldn't believe it. Got their numbers, met with them later. I'm like, man, I'm definitely doing something wrong. I need to take lessons from Arthur. I could tell you Arthur stories all day. He was a great guy, very good friend. And we were roommates in Fort Hood, Texas. We rented an apartment together off the base, and we got sent places together. And real nice guy, just extremely smart. And what was really funny is, so Arthur was black, like I told you. He was Jewish, and he spoke Polish. I learned Russian. He learned Polish. And so as I'd always make jokes about it. I go, damn, Arthur, you are one poor discriminated against mofo. You got troubles. You are discriminated against on every level. We got Polish jokes for you. We got Jewish problems. You can't eat any food in the military. And well, geez, you're black in a military intelligence unit. One of very few, at least at that time. But he was funny, very nice guy. Anyway, he and I got sent to Alaska in January. We're going to be there a month for some exercise because we were experts in the equipment, because Fort Hood always was the largest base and we always got the equipment first. And so we got these really cool, they were called Turkey, TRQ, Turkey 32 Victors. And a Turkey 32 Victor back at the time was a collection and jamming, more of a collection, because the jamming would be done by the Tilkey 17 Alpha or the TAC Jam or something like that, where you would jam other type stuff. But our job was to collect Russian radio traffic and then forward the positions to the, it was a direction finding piece of equipment. And so it had these $3 million antennas back then, but it was just a pickup truck and it had a hut on the back. And anyway, we were the first to have these. And so we were going up and training a group in Alaska how to use these. And we were going to be out in the field in freaking January. And so we get up there. And in January, the sun rises at like 10:30 and sets at 2 p.m. And so it's dark all the time. And all we want to do is sleep, right? And so somehow we figured out how on the very first day to not have to go sleep outside, which is the only requirement. In 100 degree below zero temperatures, you have to sleep outside and, you know, wake up in the morning. So we missed it, and we're like, oh, damn, looks like we missed it. Well, the first sergeant made sure that we, the next night, got to go and do it. Only now, we had no protection. We had no other people out there in case something happened. It was just the two of us. And so, but everybody else had to go and do it out in some wooded area. Well, we only had to do it in the motor pool, but it was still 6 feet of snow in the motor pool. And so, basically, they taught you how to burrow into the snow, protect your sleeping materials, your sleeping bag, what you would sleep in, and you had to basically sleep there. And so you went out at 9 and you came back, you could come back in at 6 in the morning. And so Arthur and I are out there freezing our nipples off in the motor pool, sleeping in a snowbank. And well, we had already eaten, but you know, it was food was at you know, like 4:30 up there. It was nuts, and we were hungry, and so we cell phones were not a thing back then. People didn't have, I mean, people had them, but you know, extremely expensive, and we of course didn't have any. Well, either me or him ran across the street to the barracks, went inside, and ordered a pizza from Domino's and said, bring it to the motor pool. We, you know, we want it in the motor pool. He goes, motor pool? It's like, yeah, yeah, just come to the gate of the motor pool. Here it is. And we hope so middle of the night, we get middle of the night, 11:30, 12 o'clock, whatever it was. The Domino's guy pulls up, runs out of his car. He goes, what are you guys doing? It's like, eh, you know, we got to sleep in this snowbank. So we feel it's probably best that we have some food to keep us warm. You know, and we're not sleeping anyway. We're freezing our nipples off. And so we ate the whole pizza. You know, I don't remember what all we ordered, you know, and we ordered what we could. In the morning, out comes the first sergeant to wake us up. He came out about 5:30, make sure we didn't die. And they're laying next to us were these empty boxes and trash. And he's like, you assholes. And he was making fun. I don't know why I'm telling you that story. I forgot all about that story and forgot all about Alaska, except the very beautiful Eskimo chicks that were up there when I was a kid. And we were chasing them around. Arthur and I could tell some stories about time in Alaska for a month. And we had a good time up there, and it was always dark. I was always tired, but I really liked it. Anyway, I'm really glad there were no tsunamis that took out anything up there, because it's a fantastic place. I always wanted to get up there in summertime, because the reverse is true. The reverse is true, and the sun stays up all the time. Everybody knows this. I don't know why I'm telling you the obvious, but the Army, in its wisdom, never sent me during the summer. I got sent in the... Oh, I had to make the best of it, though. There, I got to go to Alaska. I've been to all 50 states, and that one, you know, is a little on the harder side to get to. Knocked that one out in 1989 or 90. Can't remember. I think it was 89, but who the hell can tell in these days of trouble and gloom. But anyway, they're still monitoring these situations with the aftershocks, and you know, are keeping track of the sea levels, and public alerts are still out there. But and I was going to play an audio of it, but most of it turned out to, or a video. What does JR call him? JR calls him the Sounder. I was going to call. I like that. Maybe I'll steal it. But nah, I'm not going to. So the bottom line is the threat passed without incident. Warnings have been lowered and then canceled. There's no damage or casualties. Aftershocks are going to continue probably through the week, some of them being pretty large. And we should all be vigilant if we live near Alaska's southern coast. Pay attention. Listen to the news or follow up. That's about it. I'm not going to play the sounders I got there, but that one kind of jumped in off the page at me. I'm going to jump to trade. So everybody knows my issues with Trump and his tariffs and with BRICS and with all these things. There's been a lot of news lately, and I mean a lot, about these tariffs. And everybody knows I have an economics background from college, and I've always enjoyed demand and supply curves and checking out how things affect other things. I'm interested in how systems work and how people relate to those systems. Oh, by the way, I don't think I said anything when I started that you can listen to all my past podcasts and shows at internationalflavor.com. It's certainly permitted, And you can listen if you like. And what I'm thinking is that if you wanted to, you could also phone in and speak to me and on either Alaska or any of the other topics I'm going to bring up. One of them is the quick, and I mean quick, changes that are occurring that are directly a result of Trump's tariffs against China. And you don't have to agree with me, but boy, you better listen. You better. We need to adjust, and I'm not so sure that we ever will, because our government is very stupid, and the people are still, there's so many people still living in a place that no longer exists, that I'm really troubled for where we go in the future. And I want to take a look in particular, and you know, there's two videos that I saw today, and one of them I might even play for you, but I want to explain why first. Because, and headlines, two huge headlines have come up that I'd like to tell you about. And here we are talking about food. Initially, we're talking about beef and exports of beef here on International Flavor, where the truth just tastes better. We are now talking about food. Well, food is one of my favorite topics. And I don't know. I think that we really need to have a look at this. I'm going to go deep into the tariff headlines, the things that are coming out. Literally, we were just talking about earthquakes, the seismic shifts in global trade that are going to reshape the world as we know it. You don't have to believe me. You can research it for yourself, but I really believe I'm going to play this 21-minute cut for you after I talk about it for a bit, but give you more of a roundabout way, and then feed you into it. America's losing its place at the global dinner table, while countries like China, Russia, and Brazil are setting up a whole new banquet and a whole new feast. And now it's hitting food, okay? First, beef. China rejected, just in the last few days, 150,000 tons of U.S. beef worth $500 million. Why did they do this? On the surface, they say it's because of health concerns. But if we look at it further, this is retaliation. It's absolutely, unequivocally retaliation. It's a strategic chess move by Xi Jinping and company, by Lula in Brazil, and especially by Vladimir Putin. And this is going to hurt. This is definitely going to hurt. And it's part of the reason I want to play that cut for you, because it's the farmers definitely know it. The beef industry definitely knows it. And it's hitting soybeans, hitting a bunch. And I want to tell you about a bunch of it. And then I'll play you the video about the beef, because this is important. And you know what? When you lose a market, it's going to be extremely hard to get it back. Now, you could say it's a small deal. 150 tons of beef stopped. Much more of it curtailed altogether, and not going to be a big sale portion. And China only imported 12% of its beef from the United States anyway. But since 2023, that historic number has dropped to below 6. And it's going to go lower after this. And so I'm telling you, China, BRICS, the rest are making different moves, okay? It wasn't just a replacement, that's why. I mean, a rejection of the beef. It is a replacement. And guess where they're replacing? First, let's talk about this. So they rejected these 150,000 tons. Then they They're fighting this over the electric vehicle tariffs that are put out. States like Texas, Nebraska, and Kansas saw orders vanish overnight. Ranchers were dumping products. It's going to make it cheaper on the domestic market, beef, which is nice for us, because the market is already saturated and prices are going down, which would be helpful. But it wasn't just a rejection, it's a replacement. And who are they replacing it with? Russia. Russia had a 2023 certification agreement and a brand new rail corridor to Western China, which was finished up immediately in 2024. They've got that done. Their beef exports to China have surged over 300% in quarter one of 2025. And no transactions in dollars. They're all done in the ruble or the yuan. Okay, that's just beef. Then came soybeans. Days ago, China canceled 2.4 million tons of U.S. soybean orders. $1.1 billion gone in hours, right? Inventories are going up. Prices are tanking. Iowa farmers are caught off guard mid-season, watching months of planning that they got to figure out how to deal with. Okay, China, again, pivoted. Brazil filled the soybean gap without blinking, supported by over $11 billion in Chinese-backed logistics that Russia has been building with its belts and bridges, rails, ports, grain terminals. Brazil now supplies over 70% of China's soybeans. Okay? Now, you can still argue, you can yell, you can say that the U.S. is the biggest market in the world. And we are. But we also want to ship our stuff out. Okay? And these countries are pivoting. What three countries are these? They're BRICS members. And it's getting it. This is being forced on people. Okay? Let's keep going. China paid a premium of up to $22 a ton over and above the U.S. prices to secure the transition. Why would they do that? Why? Well, the argument is because trust, logistics, and alignment now matter more than cost. They don't want to be told what they're going to do by the United States. They want to be treated fairly, and they're not. Now, I want Trump to do something, but I think it's too little too late. And as I've said before, it is now we've made our own bed, and freaking fortunately, we're going to have to lie in it. And now Trump, who has to take these drastic measures to attempt to save the U.S. economy, is establishing these huge tariff fees, which is only speeding up the decline. Okay, you don't have to agree with that. I mean, hip, I've been wrong before. Well, we shall see. I don't think so. I think it's, you know what? It might make us reflect and make it more available and lower our prices here. That's a good thing. There's nothing wrong with that. Why are we shipping it all out to China anyway? If we hate them, you know, if they're our enemy, then why are we bothering? You know, why don't we, start supplying and taking care of ourselves? Okay. But it didn't stop with soybeans either. China also slashed U.S. corn imports by 29% and signed a $2.6 billion corn deal, also with Brazil. It released over 1 million tons of U.S. corn from state reserves. What's the message? America's role in China's food security is no longer needed. It is not essential to them. They are creating alternative pathways, and they're doing it without the dollar. They're doing it without U.S. transportation requirements. They are building their own. And I hate to say it, friends and neighbors, the time of China is coming. But let's talk about the BRICS food corridor, which also absolutely exists. Okay, this is bigger than a few bad deals. What we're witnessing is a shift. Systemically, the entire system is changing. China is building a BRICS-based food corridor. Brazil, Russia, India, China, South Africa, and all the other new members under BRICS Plus. They're trading in local currency, bypassing dollars completely. They're backing rail line storage and ports. Russia's Glavprodukt, once a domestic food brand, is exporting to China and North Korea using infrastructure nationalized when Western structures left. Think about this. Over 64% of China's agricultural imports, which we really would like to be a part of, because the world is changing. We are still the biggest market, but only when you talk straight GDP, when you talk purchasing power, purchasing parity power, China is number one. And that makes sense. India's not too far off, by the way, because of all of the people, especially with agriculture, and we're losing the market. We aren't doing our farmers any favors. Now, since we're the largest, consumers on the planet, maybe it's okay. I don't know. But this systemic shift, people better get the idea of it. Let's check out the logic of it, though. This activity wasn't really reactive. This was planned. This has been architectural. It's a blueprint. They have built China and Russia and Brazil have been building this blueprint for a while, since 2007, but especially from 2020 to 24. Brazil expanded soybean acreage by 21%, and China funded it. They financed the inland railways to reduce trucking cost and port congestion. This is logistics diplomacy, and infrastructure is leverage. Every grain reserve policy has been weaponized. By shifting reserves and freezing U.S. contracts, China is manipulating the global grain prices themselves without the U.S., who used to control them all. And the biggest problem with us, let's talk about currency. 95% of China-Russia trade now happens in the yuan and ruble. That was not true 4 short years ago. The Belt and Road Agra Rail corridors use local clearing systems. What happened to U.S. exporters? They are frozen out. Even if tariffs are lifted tomorrow, the structure, the inspection systems, the customs protocols, the payment platforms are already gone from dollar-based trade between Russia and China, and Brazil and China, and India and China. They're not using dollars anymore, people. And farmers aren't just losing money. They're losing access to the Chinese market, and contracts are lapsing, and there's nobody to step immediately in to help them out. Now, that's not to say the end is near or anything like that. I'm not saying that. But you're losing huge, huge amounts of market share right now. And without aligning infrastructure to Western-based platforms, what's going to go up? Infrastructure, delivery costs, everything. For us, it's going to be the opposite of what it has been. Without currency flexibility, partners are opting to go elsewhere. Iowa, Missouri, Kansas, they aren't just red states, they're economic red zones now. The U.S. has got to pivot. This is what I'm saying. What do we got to do? We got to modernize our own ports and rail lines, which we've not done. We have to support digital logistics, blockchain certifications, insurance diplomacy, invest in trade, not with our allies only, but with those that are sitting on the fence. Rethink trade policy around resilience, not dominance, and that is our problem. We must be in charge. And we all think, well, geez, we have the biggest market in the world. They want to be with us. I can't tell you how often I hear that. Sure, they'd love to be with us, but they aren't willing to sell their left nut to do it. Those days are gone. Because why? Friends and neighbors, there are alternatives, and they're going there. These sanctions and tariffs and BS that the U.S. is pushing out, they aren't going to change anything. I don't want to talk about today. We're going to talk about some Zelensky, but from a different point of view today. And we might get as far as I might not get as far as I wanted to, because I do want to play this 21 minute segment just so you can, you know, not from me. And I did a full deep dive. I watched like 8 of these that went, different from different points of view in Russian and English. I even saw a German one, because guess who else is pivoting? NATO. Our freaking own allies are pivoting. They don't like the tariff wars that are going on with Trump. You know, Trump's going to fix it. I'm not sure he's wrong. Trump realizes what's the problem. He gets it. But it's too late. Now you're going to force all this stuff. We have to be more friendly. And we're not. And I personally am afraid for what this means for our children. You know, I eat far less than I did before anyway. So for me, hopefully it's not going to be all that huge of an impact. I would like to see the price of beef go down. That's for sure. I don't know. China's pivot from U.S. beef and soybeans and corn isn't just a market signal. It's the redrawing of a global map. And if we don't do something to act cohesively together with the rest of the world, and boldly and strategically and honestly, and change the way we deal with the rest of the world diplomatically, Lindsey Graham and company, if we don't do that, we're not just going to lose contracts. We're going to lose relevance ourselves. I'm telling you, I suppose I could encourage you to stay hungry in finding out news about this stuff. And again, don't get your sources just from me. Pull up your own analysis. But I am going to play this video for you and let you hear yourself. And it's a longer video, almost 22 minutes, okay? And I'm not going to skip, because it talks about a lot more than just beef. But it starts with beef. Ready?
U.S. beef industry leaders are confident longstanding Chinese restrictions on imports of U.S. beef will be lifted. China is concerned about the safety of U.S. beef since the mad cow disease broke out in 2003.
Some experts are saying the increases could come as a result of the new reciprocal tariffs put in place yesterday by President Trump. So what does all of this mean for our local beef cattle and pork farmers? Mark Liffenberg breaks that down.
China has recently halted over 150,000 tons of U.S. beef imports with little warning, causing a major shakeup in global agriculture trade. The move came after new U.S. tariffs on Chinese electric vehicles were announced. Analysts believe this rejection of meat products, worth around $500 million, is more than just a matter of health standards. It reflects growing strategic tensions. As American suppliers face sudden losses, another player is stepping in to fill the gap, reshaping the landscape of international food trade. Before we begin, make sure to hit the like button. It helps us beat the YouTube algorithm. According to trade experts, the rejection of U.S. beef shipments followed unpublicized...
Unfortunately, they asked me to click on that like button several times. So ignore that part, but sorry to point that out.
Inspections in Chinese ports shortly after the U.S. expanded tariffs. While China cited safety regulations, economic analysts argue the decision was a calculated response to recent policy changes. U.S. beef exports to China had been on a sharp rise, reaching over $1.2 billion in 2024. Cutting that access without prior negotiations points to a larger shift in trade relations rather than isolated regulatory concerns. Before we continue, make sure to hit the subscribe button. It really helps the channel grow. The impact was immediate. Over $520 million in beef orders were canceled or diverted in a matter of weeks, according to the USDA. States like Texas, Kansas, and Nebraska major suppliers to China were hit especially hard. Ranchers faced oversupply with nowhere to send their products, resulting in falling prices and financial strain. One cattle producer from Nebraska told reporters that contracts prepared months in advance are now being liquidated at a loss in the domestic market. Beyond the farms, ripple effects have been felt across related industries. Feed suppliers, transportation companies, and cold storage services have seen disruptions, and layoffs are already being reported. The response from China, while framed around quality control, is widely viewed by policy analysts as a strategic counter to U.S. trade measures. With farm states forming a key part of American electoral politics, this shift in agricultural trade could carry deeper political consequences. In the midst of this disruption, Russia has rapidly increased its beef exports to China. In the first quarter of 2025 alone, Russian shipments jumped more than 300% compared to the previous year. This growth was made possible by a 2023 agreement between China and Russia that streamlined certification processes and allowed exports from dozens of previously restricted Russian facilities. These moves have allowed Russia to become a viable alternative for Chinese meat imports. Key infrastructure investments have played a major role in Russia's emergence as a top supplier. A rail corridor opened in late 2024 now connects Russian beef producers directly to Western China, dramatically reducing transport times. Payments are being made in yuan or rubles, avoiding reliance on U.S. dollars. Trade officials in Russia have credited the rise in exports to strategic partnerships and efficient logistics, positioning the country as more than just a short-term replacement. China imports about a quarter of its total beef consumption. The U.S. previously filled a large portion of that demand, but Russia is catching up. The Russian government has introduced a $1.1 billion investment plan to double its beef production by 2027, with large-scale farms under development. While questions remain about food safety and logistics, China appears to be prioritizing suppliers who align with its political and economic goals, even if they come with some operational challenges. Meanwhile, traditional beef suppliers such as Argentina and Australia are facing their own hurdles. Argentina has struggled with high inflation and trade instability, making its pricing unpredictable. Australia, although gradually rebuilding trade ties with China, continues to face intermittent inspection issues. These complications have made it difficult for both nations to offer the stability that China now seeks in its food supply chains. Russia's rapid rise isn't just due to increased output. It's about compatibility with China's evolving trade preferences. In early 2025, most of Russia's beef shipments were transacted in local currencies, avoiding dollar-based systems. Faster rail delivery and a focus on long-term trade alignment have helped Russia position itself as a preferred supplier. For China, reliability and strategic cooperation seem to outweigh concerns over perfect volume or quality. In March 2025, China imposed new tariffs on over 700 U.S. agricultural products, including pork, dairy, almonds, and sorghum, affecting more than $11 billion in trade. This move came just after the U.S. reintroduced tariffs on Chinese tech goods. These shifts signal a broader trade divergence, where agriculture is being used as a lever of international negotiation. Analysts believe the pattern reflects more than short-term retaliation. It may mark a permanent realignment. The numbers tell the story. In 2022, the U.S. held over 12% of China's imported beef market. By early 2025, that share had dropped below 6%. With no signs of diplomatic repair, industry experts are warning that U.S. suppliers could be locked out of one of the world's fastest-growing protein markets. As China builds new trade systems with nations that share its strategic priorities, traditional suppliers may find it harder to re-enter. The U.S. has signaled it will expand tariffs on even more Chinese goods, another $18 billion worth, raising concerns from international organizations. Data shows U.S. farm exports to China are already down nearly 28% this year. According to economists, such cycles tend to shrink global markets rather than protect them. Meanwhile, China is locking in long-term food supply deals with Russia and others, many of which avoid using the U.S. dollar entirely. This shift isn't just about tariffs or trade. It reflects a larger change in global supply chains. China is increasingly partnering with countries that offer political alignment, stable logistics, and flexible financial terms. If the U.S. doesn't adjust its approach, it risks not only losing market share, but also becoming isolated from future growth in Asia's agricultural sector. As trade dynamics evolve, the focus must shift from short-term retaliation to long-term strategy. What's unfolding now is more than a trade dispute. It's a signal of shifting power dynamics. When China alters its supply chains, especially for essentials like food, it doesn't just impact one country. It reshapes regional alliances and long-standing business relationships. By strengthening ties with nations like Russia and Kazakhstan, China is building a food security network that reflects not only economic interests, but also shared diplomatic goals. These decisions ripple out far beyond beef. Trade experts are watching this closely. Deborah Elms of the Asian Trade Center notes that once infrastructure, payment systems, and certification standards are in place with new partners, it becomes very difficult for previous suppliers to re-enter. It's not just a matter of fixing relations. It would require completely rebuilding the systems that support trade. This is why some believe the U.S. is not just losing access temporarily, but could be facing long-term exclusion from key markets. Meanwhile, China isn't relying solely on foreign suppliers. Domestic beef production rose over 5% in 2024, backed by state investment in regions like Inner Mongolia and Sichuan. China is clearly pursuing a two-track strategy: secure external partnerships where political and financial terms align, while also building internal capacity to reduce dependency. For U.S. exporters, this means facing both growing competition abroad and increasing self-sufficiency within China. With long-term beef contracts already in place between China, Russia, and Kazakhstan, the window for the U.S. to re-enter the market is narrowing. Many of these deals are structured around local currency settlements and multi-year commitments, elements that are strategically designed to reduce reliance on dollar-based trade. If these partnerships hold, the U.S. risks being replaced not just temporarily, but structurally, as China diversifies and secures its protein sources. At the heart of all this is the question: can American agriculture adapt? The U.S. has long relied on global demand, especially from Asia, to drive exports of beef, soybeans, pork, and dairy. But as new trade alliances solidify and currency systems evolve, American producers may need to pivot, either by finding new markets or by reshaping trade strategies to meet emerging global expectations. Failing to do so risks permanent loss of influence in the global food trade. While many U.S. farmers and exporters are waiting for a diplomatic resolution, the data suggests a deeper reset is underway. With retaliatory tariffs continuing and long-term agreements being signed between other nations, it may not be enough to simply wait for tensions to cool. A proactive strategy, one that considers alternative markets, improved bilateral engagement, and better integration with new global financial systems could be essential moving forward. China's trade decisions are clearly no longer driven solely by economics. Food imports, once a straightforward matter of supply and demand, are now deeply intertwined with diplomacy and global positioning. This strategic use of agricultural trade allows China to reward alignment and discourage opposition without resorting to more direct confrontation. It's soft power with high stakes, and it's changing the rules for global commerce. For viewers watching this shift unfold, it's worth considering the broader implications. Trade disruptions aren't just about tariffs or prices. They influence jobs, food prices, and rural economies across the world. As the global food system becomes more politically influenced, stability will increasingly depend on cooperation, adaptability, and trust. Without those, even the most established trading relationships can unravel overnight. The developments in U.S.-China agricultural trade are just one chapter in a larger story of economic decoupling. From semiconductors to soybeans, both countries are reshaping how they interact economically. What once seemed like isolated policy decisions are now part of a pattern: nations aligning their supply chains with geopolitical allies instead of traditional trading partners. For American agriculture, this means that success will increasingly depend not just on quality and price, but also on diplomacy and alignment with shifting global trends. As new supply routes and agreements solidify, it's clear the landscape of global food trade is being redrawn. China's shift toward Russia and other politically aligned nations is a signal that trade is no longer just transactional, it's strategic. Nations are preparing for a future where trade disruptions may become more common and where resilience is built through diversified partnerships, robust infrastructure, and currency independence. In this new environment, adaptability is not optional, it's essential. Looking ahead, it's possible we'll see further developments: more investment in local production across Asia, additional long-term contracts bypassing traditional Western exporters, and possibly even a broader move away from dollar-based trade in agriculture. These changes won't happen overnight, but the foundation is already being laid. Countries are thinking in decades, not months, and U.S. exporters will need to make long-term strategic adjustments to stay competitive. Still, there is room for course correction. Trade is a living system, and history has shown that relationships can evolve. For the U.S., that might mean re-engaging with multilateral trade frameworks, revisiting tariff structures, or building new alliances in Southeast Asia, Africa, or Latin America. It may also require embracing financial systems that better match the realities of a multipolar world. These are not easy changes, but they may be necessary to maintain relevance in an evolving global economy. This story also highlights the growing role of infrastructure diplomacy. China's Belt and Road Initiative, Russia's rail corridors, and yuan-ruble trade mechanisms are more than just tools for commerce. They're strategic levers. The U.S. and its allies may need to invest not only in domestic competitiveness, but also in external systems that support open, stable, and trusted trade. Without that, market share can erode, not through competition alone, but through being structurally outpaced. At the consumer level, these shifts could eventually affect global food prices and availability. When supply chains reroute and currency systems shift, costs adjust, and availability varies by region. Food that once flowed freely across borders may now be directed through more politically aligned routes. Understanding this helps all of us become better informed, not just as citizens, but as consumers in an increasingly interconnected and complex world economy. So what can we take away from this? Trade is about more than goods and services. It's about trust, alignment, and long-term planning. Whether you're a rancher, policymaker, or consumer, staying informed about global trends is more important than ever. The rise of new players, the retreat of old ones, and the evolving map of global agriculture all point to one truth. The future of trade belongs to those who adapt. It's important to emphasize that these trade realignments don't happen in isolation. They're influenced by everything from political leadership changes to shifts in global energy, finance, and climate policy. For instance, weather disruptions, disease outbreaks.
All right, they're getting a little too preachy for me. I watched all that before, but I really don't want to hear that again. I mainly wanted to hear the first parts about the huge changes that occurred. And I tell you what, it's in part a little bit scary is not the right word, concerning, you know, that we aren't thinking a little differently in this regard, that Trump isn't thinking differently. Like I said, I think a lot of the things that he is doing, especially internally, are doing good. And by the way, even this isn't necessarily long-term bad news. You know, this is if what Russia has been doing is recreating its self-reliance, self-sufficiency, which they're and focusing on regional partnerships, why wouldn't the same thing work for us? And by the way, it would. If we focused on Canada, on Mexico, on our strategic, more local partners and tried to build something that other people wanted to be a part of, which they do because we're still the biggest, baddest ass on the planet, you know, for now. and I don't mean anything negative about that. I'm a patriot, you know. I believe in us. I believe a lot in us, but I also believe that our government sucks, and our government hasn't done us any favors in years. They have, you know. I hate. I mention this a-hole every day, but the thinking of the Lindsey Grahams of the world has got to change. That all you want to do is talk about how big and bad and tough we are and how we're the biggest and we're never going away. Eesh, I wish you'd go away if you believe that way, because it is not conducive to an effective global strategy. Our global strategy is in the toilet. I have the rest of the segment here. I want to give you kind of a, if we have time to get to the news on some of the big things that are happening in the on the Ukraine side, and talks about what von der Leyen and Kaja Kallas has made another genius statement. Her genius statement is that, and I wish I had the recording of it, but it was pretty damn comical. She said, well, if you're giving us the weapons, but we have to pay for them, and then we have to give them to Ukraine, it's not as if you're giving them anything, is it? And we think that you should have to give them this stuff. So now they're all coming unglued over there that we aren't doing what we did under Biden, which is increase and just throw money at it and be done. And they're talking about a lot of talk about the 50-day BS. I'm kind of, you know, spitballing a little bit that together because I want to spend some time on this next section because I think it's important when your global structures are changing. I gave you plenty of news. Let's see if there's anything I missed in my notes. Did you get in that video that the drop in U.S. agriculture supplied to China just this year is down 28% from what it was last year? Now, is China all that interested in the U.S. markets and selling over here? No. You heard it three or four times in that video. Three or four. I heard it at least that many. Of course, I watched the whole thing twice. And when you listen to what they are saying, and they're right, by the way, it's that China is focusing more on global strategic partnerships than they are upon today's money. Do you remember me? So when I was in the Army, when I was in college before the Army, now I have a degree in economics. I have another degree in Russian studies or focus in Russian studies. Call it a minor, right? And then I have my law degree. And I have always said that one of the things I always respected about the Communist Party and about what they tried to do is they try to think long term. And how do they do this? They did it, and China still does it. They have 5-year plans, 10-year plans, 30-year plans, 100-year plans. Where are we going to be? They're thinking long term about their country. We're thinking next week. We're thinking, you know, Trump's thinking right now. What do they think of me right now? Better put out a tweet. Better put out a Truth Social. Better say something. The short term doesn't create a strategy. It doesn't do anything. And the trouble with our country, friends and neighbors, is we're run by people that think only of themselves. They don't think of the rest of us. They are doing it by no plan, but everybody is involved in their own personal little popularity contests at every level of government. It's depressing. And in part, it's because of the fact that you have to get reelected and you have to kiss the butt of the public. And we have short memories. And we don't think, at least governmentally, we don't think long term because our government has never instructed us to do so. Never. And I mean never. They talk about, you know, we can't even rebuild our infrastructure in any serious way. How long have we been talking about collapsing bridges and old rail lines and highway systems that suck and rail systems that suck and port systems that really need overhaul. And I mean big freaking money. But we'll send, you know, billions off to Ukraine for what? To show that we're the biggest, baddest ass in the world. You know, I like that Trump's not doing that anymore. So let's see. The other final point, well, not quite, but the other final point I wanted to make on this is that the problems are with systems and systemic types of efforts. Because remember, and you heard it in that video, you've heard me say it forever, the BRICS is an alternative structure. They are having to recreate from scratch their own structure, and Trump realizes it because he's trying to stop them from creating it
threatening tariffs against anybody that goes with BRICS, because he sees the writing on the wall. And in the creation of these payment structures, which are already working, food corridor, this is the first time I really heard the word food corridor, to coin a phrase, and that Russia and China and Iran and India and many others over there and in Brazil and South Africa are creating their own food corridors. And we're creating what? A vacuum. Where all of the farmers or trade organizations that have for decades supplied stuff to China have dealt with the international quality, and I forget the name of it, but there's an international quality system, and it's why some of the foods that are globally accepted are being canceled elsewhere. Well, because they get rejected. And if you're Russia, you're getting rejected all the way along. But a 300% increase in beef imports from Russia to China this year is huge. It's at least that $150 billion. The amount of trade that has gone up is astronomical. And that needs to be remembered. Let's go back to the BRICS-backed food corridors. This broader pivot is toward multipolar food supply chain systems that don't depend on the dollar. Trade amongst BRICS nations is conducted in their own national currency. All of them are bypassing the dollar, and it is growing. Russia is leveraging seized Western food firms like Glov Product to produce exports tailored for China. They took, Glovport had to leave, and so Russia just took over everything they already had and just started doing the same thing. Started doing it, took over the company, took over the property, seized it all, but it's allowed because it was abandoned by these large, U.S. investors. And now the investors went back and they can't get back in. The infrastructure for belts and roads, they're trying to harmonize the type of the rail line. Because remember, I told you a lot of the like your Kazakhstans of the world, your Stans, your Irans, your Afghanistans, and several of the others, and Russia, they have different size of rail, and so a standard rail car won't fit on there. They have to change all of the rail lines, and they've been doing that, but they're investing the money. Russia does the same thing that China does in having these long-term plans that they set and they follow. Our government does not do that at all. We overspend. It's only one hand washes the other with no real strategic plan at all. And it's depressing. Let's see what else beyond beef. I wanted to finish up. I got a little bit left here on this topic. We have U.S. beef export registrations under the trade deals. They lapsed in March 2025 and didn't get renewed. USDA and exporters are in limbo now because they have no access to the Chinese market and no clear path to get back. Exporters face not just sales loss, but the infrastructure loss. More importantly, the global lost relationship between suppliers they may have had forever, and China just pulled the plug. Said, well, good luck to you. And that's it. It's a plus or minus decision. It's either one way or the other. They're not going to go back. Think about this. Russia now surpasses the U.S. also in spring wheat exports to China. The export of yellow peas and winter wheat are set to expand even more. South American countries like Brazil and Argentina are deepening Chinese ties despite inflation and logistics because China's a reliable partner for them. I tell you what, What can the U.S. do right now? Let's not be totally not positive, okay? They can adapt to multipolar things. That's going to be so difficult because we have Donald Trump. We have idiots like Lindsey Graham. All they think about is we're the biggest, we're the baddest ass, we're the best. Okay, good for you. Good for you. I hope we are. I think I'd rather be a silent but equal partner than I'm the best. I'm the best. I'm the best. The person who's in the room shouting that he's the best all the time. Well, other people allow him to listen to that, but it might not go on forever. Okay. So adapt to multipolar finance. Rebuild plant registration trusts. These new certification systems, we better get involved with them. They're coming anyway. So if you're going to have to deal with them. Don't be stuck in the old ways. Better change it. We need to diversify our own markets. We don't need to focus just on China, Southeast Asia, all of it, Africa. Although we've pissed them all off too, and they want us out of there. We need to change. And the other one is invest in our own infrastructure diplomacy, just like the Belt and Road Initiative. Maybe we could compete with that, but we really don't. Hell, we don't even do our own Belt and Road Initiative in America. It's nonsense. We're the only developed country without a high-speed rail line between a couple of big major cities. It's nonsense. California's trying to build one, but then I haven't heard how far they got. Well, but listen, on the final word on this topic, this isn't just about beef. This is about who ultimately is going to control the global food trade, right? It's coming. Post-dollar, post-America-centric world. Russia and China are building systems where trust, logistics, and currency are independent, and they matter more than brand reputation or historic dominance. If the U.S. fails to adapt, it might not just lose market share, it may become irrelevant in future food security networks. I'm telling you, I hate to think and even believe that way, but I do, and I think it's very reasonably based. My belief, my fears, my ideas are, as I've told you in the past, sometimes they just... if it sounds right, it's right. And this is absolutely right. And it is wrong to try to force something that is just going to make the decline go quicker. Mr. Trump, please, I say. Well, I hope y'all enjoyed that segment. I enjoyed researching it. I enjoyed looking into it. I got plenty of at least 8 to 10, which I'll try to put out in some of the links later, of where these video are, where you can find ours, where they are, and you can find more information on this important topic, in my humble view. Okay. My final segment, I have been lax in keeping track of the old Green Goblin. Okay. And I think, and what I've done, and I've been putting it together for a few weeks, here and there, picking up history about him, picking up where he came from, picking up some of that. I'm pretty sure I can fit in everything that I've done, but this is truly a pretty deep dive on the old Vladimir Zelensky. And I want to start with this. You hear me call him the Green Goblin. No, I stole that. And I'm not sure if I stole it from my friend Alex Christoforou or if he stole it from somebody else and just uses it. But I like it. There are 5 nicknames and public images that he has. I'm going to tell them to you and tell you where they came from and who uses them. Let's see. There's a guy named, the Green Goblin, where they say this came from. And the Green Goblin came from a guy named Alexander Dubinsky. And he's at kp.ru referencing crackdowns on dissent is where that came from. He allegedly came up with that name. It's used all the time by Alex Cristoforo. And heck, many of us now. Now it's pretty well spread out. There's also the Unthankful Queen. And Zeladron is how that goes. And there are bloggers mocking his reliance on drones and Western donations. And, lots of people do. And he deserves it in a lot of respects. What's the other one? Mr. Nonsense / Madman, people use him. And that's used sarcastically in Russian press and political satire, although I've only heard it once. Servant of the Oligarchs. Now, this is a play on his TV show that he was a part of, Servant of the People. And I'm going to go a little bit into that for you as well and where he came from. Donald Trump calls him the dictator without elections. Let's see. There's another, King and Fool, an ironic label referencing Zelensky's alleged purchase of royal real estate in the UK. Now, that has been debunked, but people still keep going back to it, that his wife has it, that they have an island home, that they bought the castle in England. I don't know the truth to that, but it is still rampant out there if you wanted to go out and have a look for yourself. You could go and find some of those things. Let us go back to... Because this is from Russia. I did a bunch of them. Russian sources, Ukrainian sources, and plenty of English sources. Okay. I also asked for, trying to find out about his money. I want to know about his money. And so let's start with, and I'm going to go back and forth in this. He's an interesting guy, even if you can't stand him like me. Do you remember George Costanza? Can't stand you. Remember George? Can't stand you. Well, I can't stand this guy. He drives me crazy. And it starts with this idiotic outfit he wears every day. Something has to happen. But where he came from. He was born into a Jewish family. He was born in Ukraine, but to Russian speaking. And everybody in his family speaks Russian, all the people. I wanted to do a little bit of a dive into this Russian language part too. And I hope I get to it, but there's a ton of material I have dug up on him. And I somewhat was planning an entire hour and a half show to this clown. There's another guy... Borzikman, that this political clown and dead men walking. I can't tell you how many times I've heard him say that when you look at his videos, when he talks about Zelensky, just like when over here, Hillary Clinton says something about disinformation. It has to be Russian disinformation. You can't. Those words now include each other. You can't say disinformation without including the word Russia, and you can't say anything good about Russia. That's just not allowed. In mainstream media, you've got to say something negative about them every single time. Well, old Z-Man didn't do that. Not until much more recently. Because his roots were Russian. He always said he was going to protect Russian language, Russian culture. He came from his Man of the People show to centralizing his own power and destroying his political enemies using the same system that he chose to. He's just like happens here in America. Maybe he was a man of the people. He certainly got elected because people wanted to believe that there could be a man of the people. But he is certainly not a man of the people now. And I have a full list of his enemies here that used to be his close advisors. Well, he didn't begin this way, but his biggest fame was in Servant of the People and his Quartal, which means quarter or block, block. I can't remember. It'll come up here somewhere where it was. But he basically played a servant of the people. He was an idealistic teacher turned president. He won the election. A character who stood up for ordinary Ukrainians. And the image of that helped him fuel a real-world election in 2019, which he promptly abandoned anything remotely close to being a person of the people. After taking office, he shifted away from grassroots things like he had done before, public town halls, direct social media questions and answers. Now he's completely top down, completely controlled administration and communication. Most of his critics in Ukraine and in Russia argue that he has replaced a real people first message with curated state media, and don't say a word against me. They got political repression under martial law. His government has banned political opponents, banned church organizations that might be pro-Russian, Pravoslavianskaya, Russian Orthodox. Notable examples are his gray zone affiliated media outlets, you know, funded by U.S. Agency for International Development, but he gets rid of any negative discussion about him. He's destroyed Orthodox Church factions and refuses. Remember the stories about some of the priests trying to get to Rome for Passover and Easter, and he wouldn't let them leave. Has seized church assets, has done a lot of things like that. Now he's been after former party members. They've all been publicly attacked by Zelensky or legally targeted using their lawfare. This is very similar to what's gone on here against the old Trumpster. I told you this about what's going on in France and in England and in Germany right now, big time. The economic decline of Ukraine. Let's start with way and population wise and everything else. Okay, now there's some good news in here. There's a few bright spots in here, but in 2021, Ukraine's GDP was about $200 billion a year. The Russian invasion, as they like to call it, their GDP collapsed to less than $160 billion. A 19% drop. They've had a slow, somewhat recovery and modest growth. They grew more than we did last year. Sorry to yawn. 2.9%. But their projections are weak. They say maybe they'll hit 2% annual growth this year. But, of course, that is very much dependent on the trajectory of the war and if they can continue to keep foreign aid. That's the World Bank telling us that. That's the World Bank reports. But Moody's rates Ukraine's credit worthiness as CA, which is very near default territory. They have inadequate revenue. They have defaulted bonds already and very large war burdens. And Trump has done giving them money, allegedly. Their agricultural exports have rebounded a little bit, but capacity, infrastructure damages, damaged rails, infrastructure ports, all of that. But more important than that, and this is really sad because Ukraine has sold itself with the help of Zelensky and a bunch of other bad actors. Get the biggest privatization in the world is going on in Ukraine, farmland privatized since July 2021, has enabled investors like BlackRock, Archer Daniels Midland, ADM, and Cargill, Vanguard, and BNP have acquired tons of land rights in Ukraine. 30% of Ukraine's arable, that means farmable, land is now, through these companies and Ukrainian oligarchs, and the money is tied up in offshore entities, meaning not staying in the country of Ukraine. It's all going west. But people are getting rich off of this, and it's not us. Okay, Ukraine is still rich in minerals like nickel, graphite, uranium, neon, and energy components. Wartime disruption is kicking it, you know, down a lot. And the Guardian notes that Ukraine has grown. It's a success story, even, you know, that they have export, and I don't know how to measure it, but they met, it's a big amount. Their electricity exports were boosted from 5 gigawatt to 85 gigawatt, or is it gigawatt, where you got to run through. Remember Doc on Back to the Future? Anyway, but they're still 20% below pre-war output, and manufacturing is less than half of what it was before. The 2023 Ukraine Development Fund, this is the criminal story of BlackRock, which is fully supported if you are an illegitimate president named Volodymyr Zelensky, sold to BlackRock. It's a privatization vehicle, which allows some of the things that we talked about above. And it's sacrificing future national wealth of Ukraine for private profits of private oligarchical deep state individuals. That's what it is. Same people buying the land, land sales. EU Parliament data reveals massive U.S.-European agribusiness ownerships in Ukraine. Again, the same old players, BlackRock, Cargill, ADM. Mineral rights deal with the West was kicking their butts. Nobody liked that. Some reports show widespread internal alarm about that deal in particular and all the other criminal things, at least from Ukraine's point of view, that are going on from that side. Odessa in particular. The port of the Black Sea. If you pay any attention to me at all, you've heard me talk about this, because England and France in particular have been pumping huge amounts of money into Odessa, and they basically want to buy it. And since it's Russian anyway, the power people in Ukraine are allowing this kind of thing. They've been doing it forever. Ah, those Russian guys anyway, we hate them. We, you know, they're not part of us. And this is a big reason for the war, truthfully. So in Odessa in particular, post-war recovery plans are already bringing huge UK and French specific deals, you know, are hard to come by, but money is not. It shows up. This, you know, it's going to be what? A colony of France? Ukraine, a colony of France? Colony of Germany? Colony of the UN? What's it going to be? It's not going well. And there's a little bit to talk about with Zelensky's personal wealth and his spouse's status in that regard. I told you that there's a lot of people saying that he really did buy this castle in England. And he really does own all or part of an island. And he really does have places in France where he's going to go, you know, stuff like that. But his personal wealth have grown sharply since he took office in 2019. Ukrainian presidents receive modest salaries. There's nothing serious that they get. He definitely has bank transfers to offshore corporate structures and real estate holdings abroad, plenty of them. His wife, Alena Zelenska, has expanded her international role also. She's the one accused of buying a lot of these things in her own name or through other people, but providing the cash. But she is active in global health and cultural diplomacy. She's publicly funded her first lady office, which has doubled in size and expense since 2022. She splits her own time between Kyiv and the USA, a little bit of Western Europe, goes to the high-level summits, you know, but mostly she spends her time schmoozing with Western donors. Statements during the war show that she has gained quite a bit of prominence and diplomatic clout, which she had none of prior to this. And I'm not necessarily against that. You know, what else is she supposed to do? But I'm against people getting rich off of their position, but, you know, that's how it goes. I also wanted to look into Kyiv moving over to Lvov. I talked to you a little bit about that, and I found some information on it. With Kyiv under periodic ranges of Russian missile strikes, Zelensky and his cabinet are increasingly staying in Lvov and operating out of there. And many government meetings and foreign delegations arrive in the West, not at Kyiv. There are growing internal discussion about decentralizing government functions permanently to Lvov or other safe cities. These are not yet state policy, but suggest Kyiv's diminished symbiotic role and Zelensky's openness to relocating parts of power to safer environs. Zelensky is not a servant of the people. He's a servant of himself. He's just like all of ours, you know, it's identical. You get elected, you get in there. You can't do the things you said you were going to do. It's impossible, but you can sure get rich trying, right? I'm not so sure he's trying anymore, is what I'm screaming. I want to go back to his early life because, listen, there's a few things that are important to know about. He was born in 1978 in Kryvyi Rih to a Jewish family, primary language Russian, and he has performed in his own company and elsewhere in that language. Okay. He founded Kvartal 95, where he played the piano with his penis. Remember that one? And a bunch of other ones. You know, he just a little mini comic is what he is. And he starred in popular Russian language TV show Vecherny Kvartal, which is evening quarter, and briefly served as a general producer at Russia's Inter TV channel. He only closed one of his four Russian-based companies after 2014, but he continued to get profits from his own Russian film business, which he kept on, he still receives from money from Russia. In his 2019 campaign, one of his things is from his servant to the people. Now, he won by a landslide, 73%. Right now, his percentage of love-hate is far more on the hate side. It's probably flipped the other direction. I saw numbers that said he was less than 30%. But in his campaign in 2019, he said, don't ban the Russian language. Well, guess what's banned now? The Russian language. He positioned himself linguistically between the East and West Ukraine. In the eastern half Ukraine, which I was saying forever, they all speak Russian primarily and less so Ukrainian. Some of them can get by with it. I can understand parts of it, but it's totally different. I mean, lots of similarities, but different. He learned Ukraine on the air. Like he wasn't very well spoken, and so he would attempt to, and it was endearing. You know, he'd get up there and start speaking in Ukrainian and figure out where he was going and which rules he was going to apply to get into Ukrainian, because a lot of the root words are all the same. So he did it on TV, and he led his Servant to the People party, which he created, to the landslide, and he presented himself as a non-nationalist, compromise-driven candidate to try to say he campaigned on peace. Let's go through some of his backers and the broken promises that he made to him. There's a guy named Igor Igor Kolomoisky. I told you about him months ago. He's an oligarch, still is, patron via 1+1 media. And he brought to power, you know, he brought Zelensky to power, basically, his money, his activities. Initial loyalty soured immediately after Zelensky took office. And now he's gotten rid of Kolomoisky, any of Kolomoisky's, cronies, including the prosecutor general, Reba Shapka, NBU governor Smoly, Prime Minister Hansharuk, and they, you know, started investigating them deeply, all for corruption. Zelensky does that. That's how, you know, he treats his friends. Another guy named Andrei Bodin, who was appointed head of the presidential offices in May 2019 and sacked in February 2020, accused of violations and ties to oligarchs. Andrei Yermak replaced Bodin initially in February 2020 and quickly became the Green Cardinal, money man, accused of domineering style and Russian sympathy through family ties and selling things, money. Who else? Alexei Arestovich. I've told you about him repeatedly. He has his own YouTube channel now, and he speaks poorly about the things that Z-Man does. He resigned after criticizing counteroffensive, and he's accused now of being a Russian spy, although he used to be one of the inside cronies. But because he criticized a counteroffensive, which didn't go anywhere, and he said they weren't ready to do it, as many did, he was ousted. He's no longer attached at all. Yulia Mendel, press secretary, left quietly and no profile extracted after that. Mikhail Podolyak, I think he's living in England now, if I remember right, but he was a senior advisor and diplomatic spokesman, and he publicly criticized the Pope for his pro-Russian stance. Remember that? I don't know. He switches, what I always complain about is people change their opinions like they change their underwear. Man, there's so many places I could go with this because I still got a decent amount. But the long and the short of it is he's a pretty colorful entertainer. Some of the things you watched on him were pretty comical. You can still find a bunch of them on YouTube. Look at the one where he's playing the piano with his wiener with another guy. And that one's kind of comical. And there's some pretty brash stuff in there. Saturday Night Live-ish type of show on stage. Zelensky was good at it. He's a showman. He's an actor. He was very pragmatic in his Russian language, but tilted hard after that. Very anti-Russia, anti-even language of Russia. His carousel, I mean, his merry-go-round of cabinet members is nonsense, and there's rapid turnover, purging of dissenters, concentration of power under himself, but even they get ran off, you know, after a while, and he does everything to consolidate his power. He's not going anywhere with his, martial law. He flips on all the oligarchs that help him, flips and then puts them in prison or attacks them politically, economically, accuses them of being Russian spies. His teams are consistently fractured and having to start all over. Anybody who opposed publicly war messaging or strategic thinking of any kind are discredited or charged with a crime or, you know, lose their jobs. Nonsense. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. I still got more to go, and I could probably throw some more in there, but I'm really not going to. My name is Samuel Trapp. This is International Flavor, and I'm very glad to have you here tonight, and I'm very glad that you are with me. The show tomorrow is the last one for me of the week. Wednesday's a big day for Damn Radio, and we have plenty of, you know, I'm an idiot. Today's Wednesday. I'm the last one of the day today, and we'll be on Thursday tomorrow. Plenty more to go along. I will see you tomorrow at 9 p.m. Check out all prior shows at internationalflavor.com. Thanks for joining us in, and good night.